From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up at Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. It is hard to believe that the 4 years of the Trump presidency are finally coming to an end. A collective trauma exacerbated by a deadly pandemic and economic collapse, culminating in a violent invasion of the Capitol, has left Americans reeling. White supremacist violence is resurgent after Twitter waited too long to silence its chief proponent, Donald Trump. 4 years ago, I spoke with our news correspondent, Arun Gupta, who had rightly predicted the ethos of ethnic cleansing that was at the heart of the Trump administration. Here is Arun in April 2017, speaking with me in studio to assess the first 100 days of the worst presidency in history.
He's clearly completely incompetent. He's petty. He's a bully. But I've been saying for a year also the guy is a genius. You know, he's a genius at manipulating the media, people's emotions, and being a demagogue. But when it comes to actually running the Oval Office, I mean, you know, he said about healthcare. Who could imagine that it was so complicated? It's right. That's why there's, you know, tens of thousands of lawyers and policy experts. None of them imagined it could be so complicated. He said the same thing after he met with President Xi of China. You know, who thought North Korea was so complicated? Well, actually, there's a whole foreign policy and national security establishment, you know, that's been dealing with this issue for 60 years. He's very much making it up as he goes along. And my worry is you know, at this point, I'm starting to feel like, look, we've seen this movie before. There is one big plot twist, a different plot twist this time. With the Bush administration, it was planned incompetence. I think that was kind of the overarching style of the Bush administration that, you know, especially we saw with the occupation of Iraq and Hurricane Katrina, that there was incompetence was part of their planning ideology. Here, what we have is planned craziness.
That's Arun Gupta in 2017 on our program, assessing the first 100 days of the Trump presidency. Arun is an investigative journalist who's written for The Washington Post, The Nation, The Intercept, Raw Story, The Guardian, and Jacobin. He's also a regular news correspondent for our program. And he joins me once more as we mark the end of the Trump presidency. Welcome back, Arun.
Thanks, Sonali. I wasn't sure we were ever going to see this day.
That's right. Let's first talk about your feelings of what you said 4 years ago and whether that planned craziness you referred to was one common and constant theme over the past 4 years.
I think it very much is. You know, what defines Trumpism in a lot of ways is, sure, it's the ethnic cleansing, the authoritarianism, the white nationalism. I think at this point we can finally say, yeah, it's fascism. I've been saying it for years. Now, after the Capitol Hill coup on January 6th, the coup attempt, you now see the mainstream media kind of grudgingly admit, oh, well, maybe he is a fascist. But it's the sadism, you know, just that type of deliberate cruelty that the Trump administration practiced as a policy, just as to be almost as insane as possible. You know, it's the children's concentration camps. It's these horrifying refugee camps that, you know, was just a year ago that I was down there talking to you from that refugee camp in Matamoros, which has just become absolutely hellish. It's the cruelty that we've seen with the COVID-19 pandemic, just the deliberately botched response at every level, now including the vaccine rollout. So, you know, it is this kind of contradictory phenomena of it's crazy, but it is planned. In other words, there is a rationality to it.
You had said about a year ago, less than a year ago, when the pandemic was first declared, that this would mark the end of the Trump presidency. And were it not for the pandemic, we very likely would have seen a re-election of Trump because the stock market was booming and the rich were doing quite well. Do you stand by that?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, the stock market was booming and the rich were doing quite well. But let's not also forget that the Trump administration was essentially using Keynesian economics. They were pouring huge amounts of money into the economy at large. And part of that was a deal that Trump had struck with Pelosi and Schumer. You know, they were trying to keep certain levels of social support up. So Trump was happy to be funding things like food stamps, even as the Republicans in Congress were trying to cut it. So you had this kind of like weird mix of like, you know, huge increases in military spending, which do flow through a lot of the economy because so much of the production is domestic and because you have millions of people who are on the payroll of the military. Then also these massive like giveaways to the agricultural industry, which were a result of his terrible agricultural policies that resulted in huge losses for agribusiness farmers in the U.S. And then along with the social spending, it was keeping the economy at a red hot pace. And then the other side was, you know, let's not let go of the fact that Biden ran a pretty terrible campaign. And he did many of the unforced errors that Hillary Clinton did in 2016, such as not opening field offices, such as spending vast amounts of sum on television advertising instead of get out the vote. They did the exact same thing with the Latino community as in 2016, where they thought like, where their attitude, it wasn't even thinking, it was like, oh, we're just going to say Trump's racist and that'll be good enough. And Biden barely won, right? And he barely won because of the horrifying toll of the pandemic, the deaths, the economic damage, the fact that a lot of people were mobilized. And also that activists in key states saved his bacon, such as in Georgia, such as in, you know, Latino organizers and LGBTQ organizers in Arizona, such as the Culinary Workers Union in Nevada. No, these are the ones who kept those states in Biden's column or flipped them, as in the case of Georgia, Stacey Abrams. So he nearly lost despite the pandemic. So Trump would have cruised to easy victory if it were not for the pandemic.
So we also know that the last 4 years of the Trump presidency especially have laid bare the racist and white supremacist foundations of the United States, built upon them. White supremacy is resurgent. Trump certainly didn't invent it. He unleashed it and maybe emboldened far more people to sort of join this white supremacist movement. We see so many reports of, you know, former Obama voters and supporters who are now QAnon conspiracists who helped the riot on the Capitol. You know, and I'm wondering if you think that had Trump not had Fox News and the, you know, universe of right-wing media outlets echoing his claims, or Twitter to amplify his views, would we have seen what we saw over the last 4 years? If he had only at his disposal the traditional modes of getting the word out, you know, whitehouse.gov, press conferences where media would question his press secretary, if he only had those traditional modes of communication, would we have seen what we saw over the past 4 years?
You're absolutely right. It is kind of, one is the development of the right-wing echo chamber that goes back to the 1990s, and two is new mediums, right? And demagogues, successful demagogues, are very good at manipulating new mediums because people really aren't familiar with them as they existed before. So Hitler was, you know, really skilled. The Nazis were really skilled at using film. Father Coughlin, the American like quasi-fascist during the Great Depression, he was really skilled at using radio. And Twitter did allow Trump this one-to-one communication with his vast audience, and which the world was indeed hanging on. But it gave him both this huge audience and a sense of intimacy with his individual supporters. And I do want to address one point that I think is absolutely important, because we hear it all the time and still hear it all the time, is this notion that Trump is just exposing what already existed. And I think that's basically a real lazy way of thinking of what's going on. And you mentioned the Capitol. Obama supporters, one of the notable ones there was Kevin Greeson. He's the man who had the heart attack. You know, there are reports that he tased himself to death. They haven't been confirmed. But he was a vice president of his union at Goodyear in Alabama. He went to Obama's inauguration in 2008. And so in this short time, just 12 years, he goes from an Obama supporter, someone who backed progressive causes, a union official, to becoming a crazed QAnon follower in Trump's army.
And Ashley Babbitt, I understand, the woman killed by Capitol Police, was also an Obama supporter initially.
Yes, apparently she was, that she voted for Obama in 2008 as well. So the thing is, Trump is creating something new, and we have to understand that consciousness can change. And if you don't believe consciousness can change, then you might as well give up.
We're all in trouble then.
Well, exactly. And the thing is also, just look at yourself. You know, I'm using the generic you. I mean, certainly me, my consciousness changed dramatically when I became politically radicalized in college. And then it changed again, moving to New York City, in terms of like getting out of like kind of white suburbia into a much different environment. So Trump really changed a consciousness, and we have to change it back. And there are things that we can do. So for instance, there needs to be severe prosecutions of these coup plotters, because that's a thing that we've seen the last 5 years, you know, that it's the impunity that the right enjoys. We're now in the 5-year anniversary of the Bundy occupation. They enjoyed impunity. They got off without any jail time from two different trials. And that led directly into the impunity of Patriot Prayer, Proud Boys, Adam Waffen, the militias of the last 4 years. And that sense of impunity is what fueled this attempted insurrection. So there needs to be serious prosecutions. We don't need new laws. We don't need new police powers. We just need the laws that exist to be enforced. The second part is we need to give people a stake in the system. And that means give them universal health care, taxpayer-funded higher education, a Green New Deal, you know, living wage, you know, housing that is safe and affordable. We need to give people a stake in the system. And we can do that, and I think that would reduce a lot of the kind of like right-wing mass longing for violence. You'll still be left with the hardcore violent extremists. But the problem is, what do we do about Fox News? What do we do about social media?
I want to pick up on what you were
Twitter
saying.
Twitter finally shut down Trump.
I want to pick up on what you're saying with the impunity before we get back to the issue of right-wing media. I mean, you see a lot of these Trump supporters who were sort of seem flabbergasted that there are warrants out for their arrest, directly appealing to Trump for a pardon. And interestingly enough, you know, you have to think, if the House had not impeached Trump for insurrection, for incitement of insurrection, Trump would be having to, you know, would very likely be issuing those pardons. Now he's in a position where on his last day of his presidency, if he issues pardons to these people who are his followers, he directly implicates himself and risks a Senate conviction in an impeachment trial. And if it weren't for that, he wouldn't have had to pay that price. That sense of accountability that an impeachment brings with it is critical. And you know, the House had 4 long years to impeach him for many other issues. They had this one impeachment on, well, 2 articles of impeachment on a very narrow part of his presidency on the Ukraine scandal. And of course, the Senate acquitted him. Now we're seeing former Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell even admit that Trump was responsible for the attack on the Capitol. And it just seems just tragic that it had to get to the point where lawmakers were personally threatened before some of them could see that Trump needed to be held accountable at the very, very last minute of his presidency.
Yeah, but even then, a majority of the Republican caucus in the House still backed his bogus election claims. They, you know, and this is the what we exist in, right? You know, that he still has control over the party. You know, as now that we're 2 weeks on, the polling data shows the rank and file Republicans are still lockstep behind Trump. And the only way to, I think, break this fever is to show them that there is a price to pay for their actions. And, you know, I think we've all seen that video of that woman, Elizabeth from Tennessee, who was shocked that she would be maced. She's like, I stepped 1 foot inside the Capitol and I was maced. And then she's asked, why are you here? And she's just like, duh. We're here for a revolution. You know, it's that sense of white supremacy. It goes beyond white privilege, right? It's this white supremacy that they can do anything they want and get away with it. So the only way that they're going to think twice is if they start going away to jail for 10, 20, 30 years. And again, I want to be clear, this is not a call for new repressive powers, new domestic laws. It's to enforce laws against these criminals, because that's all they are.
And treat them the same way, like treat them the same way that the rest of us are treated, right? If they really were Antifa, how would the government treat them?
Well, then there'd be hundreds of dead around the Capitol.
Right, that's true. And that's certainly not what we want. You were saying about Twitter and Fox News?
Mm-hmm. Well, they're still going to exist. And you know, the way we need to approach things is not, I think, to complain about why something the way it is. It's to understand why it is the way it is. And the way it is Fox News is still going to see great benefit. That means profits, audience, and power in stoking conflict, in spreading conspiracy theories, in encouraging divisiveness and hatred. Now, part of it is it's trying to play catch up in the last few years. But when you have so much of the Republican base that has basically, you know, I don't want to say crazy, because the whole point of QAnon is, I think it's really about showing fealty to the leader, right? If you can believe that there's this, you know, global cult of Satan worshiping pedophiles who also eat children, who run the world, you will believe anything. You can do anything. So Fox News helped bring this into being, but they're also trying to play catch up. You know, they can't suddenly become the QAnon channel. I'm actually surprised that some right-wing billionaire hasn't launched a QAnon channel, realizing the amount of money that they can make. But they're going to keep encouraging it. Trump's going to keep encouraging it. And as we see from the House Republicans, you know, the House is the most representative body at the federal level in the United States. There are plenty of Republicans who see a political advantage, a power advantage, a celebrity advantage, a monetary advantage to keep stoking this conflict. And I think we are in, you know, likely in an era of kind of low-level terrorism. It's not civil war. I think we need to like reject that language. But I think we're going to see more bombings, like the Nashville bombings, like Oklahoma City. We're going to see more political mass shootings, like the Tree of Life Synagogue, like El Paso Walmart, Gilroy Garlic Festival, and perhaps also attempted political assassinations. You know, it's not a pretty future, but we have to figure out what to do about this ideological apparatus that encourages this extremism.
Finally, briefly, the Biden incoming Biden administration's flurry of actions and also nominees to head certain departments, top agencies and departments, does that promise for you a step in the right direction, or are you worried that Biden might run his presidency like he ran his campaign?
I mean, I think we're kind of seeing like contradictory signals. You know, the fact that he did endorse a $2 trillion relief bill, but at the same time, they're not playing hardball with the Republican Senate. You know, they're agreeing to essentially a power sharing agreement where they could run roughshod over him. But the problem is that they also have members, their own rank and file, especially Joe Manchin from West Virginia, who could completely turn on them. He's basically a Republican. And if he were to flip, the Republicans would be back in charge of the Senate. So I want to be cautiously optimistic, but this is a Democratic establishment we're talking about, who are just basically, you know, as I've been saying, it's a neoliberal corpse that's in charge of the party and the presidency now.
Well, Arun, I want to thank you, as always, for joining us. We shall certainly have you back on to talk about the first 100 days of the Biden presidency. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Sonali.
My guest has been Arun Gupta, investigative journalist who's written for The Washington Post, The Nation, The Intercept, Raw Story, The Guardian, and Jacobin. He's also a regular news correspondent for Rising Up with Sonali. We've been discussing the end of the Trump presidency. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.